Welcome, everybody. Good evening. We're tonight to listen to how Tanakh was put together further back in history. And Dr. Sokolow, I missed you last week, but pleasure to be back. And we look forward to today's class. How are you doing? Bakasha.
Baruch Hashem. The missing was mutual.
Okay. I was actually much closer to where you were last week, just,
I waved all the same.
Yeah, but okay. I didn't see the wave. What can we do? Okay. All right, Bakasha, let's go. Tanakh, the Farshim.
Okay. This evening, I'm going to try to combine two things. It will kind of be the last of the Melachot of Shabbat. It'll kind of be a makeba patish, putting the final touches, so to speak, on the subject of parshanot, on the subject of exegesis. But since we've already come up to the 20th century, I'm going to orient what we have to say about 20th century parshanot a little bit towards the subject of Orthodox responses to biblical criticism. So we're going to start with just a very thumbnail sketch of the documentary hypothesis, and then we'll move on to David Zvi Hoffman and at the tail end of the 19th, earliest part of the 20th century, and then actually through the 20th century, and even for that matter, into the beginning of the 21st century. And with that, we will conclude our examination of biblical interpretation, and we'll be able next week to move on to a new subject. So let me enlarge the screen and move us on. Okay, so it's kind of hard to give a brief description of biblical criticism. But essentially, biblical criticism was patterned after Homeric criticism. Somewhere in the 19th century in Middle Europe, someone decided that no one person could have written the Homeric epics. So picking certain linguistic or stylistic differences that can be discerned in the Odyssey and the Iliad, scholars eventually came to the conclusion that Homer didn't write the Homeric epics, rather they were written by a bunch of different people, and they were perhaps attributed in folklore to a single author. So that since that seemed to work with the Homeric epics, it was rather natural that these scholars should move on to other classic works of literature. So they moved to the Bible. And eventually, what emerged from the general rubric of biblical criticism is something that is called the documentary hypothesis. And of those two words, I want to place the dagesh chazak, the larger emphasis on the word hypothesis, which means that here we are, almost 200 years after biblical criticism was launched, and there is still no historical evidence for it. It is still an hypothesis. The hypothesis is, again, as it was in the case of the Homeric epics, based on certain linguistic or stylistic changes or discrepancies that can be discerned in the five books of Moses, in the Torah. And just as they decided that the Homeric epics were written by several authors, they decided that the Torah was written by several authors. And to be more precise, while they couldn't name individual authors, they named or they cited four different authorial schools. And those four different authorial schools are known each by one of the letters of the Latin alphabet, corresponding to a distinctive characteristic of the source from which that document emerged. so that the four letters of the alphabet that account for the documentary hypothesis are J, E, P, and D. J, spelling out the word Jehovah, is that source of the, that one of the documents in which the God of Israel is referred to by that name, the name that we call the Shem HaMeforash, the Yud Ke Vav Ke, the Tetragrammaton. Okay. The E source is the one that features the alternative name of the God of Israel, Elohim. The P source stands for priestly, and that's the source that accounts for largely the book of Vayikra, and throughout the other Chumashim, other things that focus either on korbanot, sacrifices, or that focus on matters of purity and impurity, which were of particular concern to the priestly class. The last of the four sources, D, stands for Deuteronomy, or more particularly the Deuteronomist. And that's the one that's responsible largely for Sefer Devarim, as well as for any place else where there are repetitions, since Deuteronomos means the second law or the repetition of the law. The D source, or the Deuteronomist, is the one whose, one of whose featured characteristics is repetition. So what you have in front of you is a page chosen more or less at random. In this case, actually more or less than more, randomly, from the Anchor Bible. The Anchor Bible is a standard of the critical school. And what you see on both the left-hand side of the page in the lower paragraph and on the right-hand side of the page in the upper paragraph, you see what everybody now knows to call a backslash. They didn't have backslashes back when the Anchor Bible was printed, but the function of those backslashes is to mark off verses that belong to a different source. So you can see that most of the text is not bracketed. So most of the text belongs to one of the documents, one documentary source, but those few verses that are bracketed are insertions or interpolations from a different source. Okay. The four highlighted words are just simply typical of what biblical criticism does. For example, on the top paragraph on the left-hand side of the page, I highlighted the word Israel. Just as God is known throughout the Torah by two different names, right? So is the third patriarch known by two different names. This is very different from Avraham, who started off life as Avram. Those aren't two different names, okay? So Avram or Avraham, Yitzchak, but then the third patriarch is sometimes Yaakov and sometimes Yisrael. So just as the documentary hypothesis posited that different sources use different names of God, and that you can therefore distinguish among the sources by the names of God that they employ, it also stipulated the same thing about the third patriarch. And therefore, sources that use the name Jacob are one source, and others that use the name Yisrael are assigned to a different source. Okay, so that's the significance of the highlighted word Yisrael. The highlight of the word Reuven in the lower paragraph on the left-hand side is to point out that there are two heroes of the Joseph story. Heroes in the sense of other brothers of Joseph who at one time or another tried to rescue him or to save him or at least to mitigate the consequences to him. One was Reuven and the other was Yehuda. So just as they believe that the story of Joseph is a composite of different narratives, one of which calls his father Jacob and the other calls his father Israel, They believe that the composite also goes so far as that there was one story that featured Reuven as Joseph's erstwhile rescuer, while another source featured Yehuda. And if you move now to the right-hand side of the page, that's one that everybody knows because, you know, Rashi, Ibn Ezra, another Parshanim have had to deal with it. And that is the question of, okay, to whom was Joseph actually sold? And who actually brought Joseph down into Egypt? Was it the Ishmaelites? As the brothers were sitting to eat, they saw an Ishmaelite caravan coming from the Gilead and heading towards Egypt. But then it says that they pulled Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Midianites. So just as there are two different sources, one of which using the name Yaakov and the other Yisrael, and there are two sources, one of those two sources features Reuven and the other features Yehuda. One of the sources has Joseph sold to the Ishmaelim, and the other has Joseph sold to the Midianim. So this, as I said, is about as far as we're going to go, at least this evening, in detailing the documentary hypothesis. I just wanted to give you a sense or a flavor of it, because we're going to focus not so much on the biblical critical view of the Torah, but we are on the orthodox responses to it. So we open with Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman. Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman, as you see on the left-hand side of the page, served as a professor of Bible and occasionally as the rector, the dean of the Orthodox Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, probably better known as Hildesheimer Seminary. And he was an outspoken and implacable opponent of biblical criticism. And here we have a segment translated, of course, from Hebrew, of the introduction to his commentary on Vayikra, which is his featured work. And in the introduction, he outlined the responsibilities of a traditional exegete of a Parshan HaMikra. And he said that every Jew who comes to interpret the Torah of Moshe is obligated to consider a special condition that will necessarily influence his commentary, as though that condition dictated rules for his Parshanot. And what is that condition? Our faith in the divinity of the Jewish tradition. Authentic Judaism, he wrote, awards the oral law the same significance as the written law, right? The Torah she'be'al peh and the Torah she'bichtav enjoy the same status. And according to several Talmudic and Midrashic traditions, they were actually revealed simultaneously. The oral law incorporates interpretations of things that are opaque in the written law, or things that are ambivalent in the written law, as well as providing us with information about commandments that are just not explicit in the Torah at all. From this, we may infer that only in very few places is it dubious what God wished to command us to do, because even if the matter is not expressed clearly in the words of the Torah, it is explained in the Torah she'ba'al peh, in the oral law. Therefore, he concluded, the responsibility of the exegete of the Parsham is solely to determine about those legislative verses why this particular idea was expressed in this particular fashion, or why these expressions were utilized rather than others. Meaning, the conclusion is a foregone conclusion. The responsibility of Parshanut is to provide a link, as it were, between the conclusions at which the Torah she'ba'al peh has already arrived and the consonantal text of the Torah she'bichtav from which it ultimately derives. However, he wrote, even in those places where an idea in the Torah she'bichtav is not clarified by the Torah she'ba'al peh, the Jewish exegete must still be cautious in his commentaries not to contradict any received halacha. Just as the written law cannot contain two things that are contradictory, so it may not contradict the oral law which also originated at Sinai. Any interpretation that is in opposition to one that we have received through rabbinic tradition, or that contains a concept that could reject a particular halacha, is to be regarded as megale panim batorah shelo kahalacha, of revealing some antinomian facet of the law, and it must be banished from the boundaries of Israel. Now, if you can remember all the way back to the session that we had on Sa'adya Gaon, I'll remind you that Sa'adya Gaon said that the default position of any biblical commentator is to assume at the outset that everything in the Torah can be understood literally. He, however, drew four exceptions to that. And what are the four exceptions to literal interpretation? If the literal sense contradicts sense perception, as, for example, saying about Chava, Eve, that she was the mother of all living creatures, right? My own two eyes tell me that that's not literally true. The second condition was if the literal sense contradicts reason. The third is if the literal sense of two verses are mutually exclusive of each other, then one of them can remain literal, but the other has to be taken figuratively. And then he introduced a fourth exception to the rule of literal interpretation, and that is if the literal sense contradicts a reliable tradition. And I mentioned to you at the time that essentially these four rules, these four exceptions to literal understanding are essentially the history of all of subsequent biblical interpretation. So here in Rav David Zvi Hoffman, 1,000 years after Sa'adya Gaon, we see him basically restating the same point. Moving along in chronological order, we come to Rabbi Joseph Hertz, who for a time was the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, and as such, was the editor-in-chief of the Hertz Sidur and the Hertz Chumash. Somehow the Hertz Chumash lasted much longer and had a much wider distribution than the Hertz Sidur, but just as the Hertz Chumash was the official Chumash of the traditional Orthodox synagogue movement in England and in the United Kingdom, so for a considerable period of time was the Hertz Sidur. In the Hertz Chumash, there is not only an English translation of the Torah text, not only annotations of that text, but there are from time to time excursies, explanatory notes. And in one of them, Rabbi Hertz responded to one of the points that was made by biblical criticism. And the point that biblical criticism made was that the story of Solomon's temple and the descriptions of temple service in Sefer Melachim in particular, they declared it to be unhistorical. On what grounds did they declare it to be unhistorical? Hertz tells us, because no king after Solomon is left uncensored by the Tanakh for having tolerated the continuance of the high places, Bamot. Right? One of the recurring phrases throughout Sefer Melachim is when a king dies. So if the Tanakh tells us how old he was when he died and how many years he reigned, and it tells us whether he did hayashar b'nei Hashem, whether he did that which was right in God's sight, or whether he did hara b'nei Hashem, whether he did that which was evil or wicked in God's sight. And a recurring phrase is, rak habamot lo saru, that only one or two of the subsequent kings of Judea ever made a successful effort to actually get rid of all of the bamot, all of the high places at which people would worship. So the Bible critics claimed that since obviously the people continued to use bamot, therefore, obviously, there was no central place of worship in Jerusalem. And here in the second paragraph, you see Hertz's rejoinder to that claim. And this is a direct quotation. He says, "It's the old familiar argument that the law, any law, could not have existed. Why? Because it can be shown that it was broken." Right? Since people were worshiping at Bamot, which is prohibited by the Torah, ergo, right, there was no temple, no centralized place of worship. And Rabbi Hertz says, according to such logic, there could never have been any prohibition law in America, because obviously it could be the law, the prohibition law, can be shown to have been broken. Again, moving chronologically, we come now to a rather interesting and, I would say, colorful figure in early 20th century Parshanot HaMikra, Moshe David Casuto, whose Italian name was Umberto. He was an Italian Jew, and as we'll see in a moment, he was not just a Bible scholar and a scholar of the ancient Near East, but he was also an historian of Italian Jewry. But he is perhaps best known for his contributions to the study of the language and literature of the Canaanite people who lived to the north of the land of Israel, right, in what is present-day Lebanon or southern Syria, and particularly the language and literature of one of the Phoenician, one of the Canaanite cities along the Mediterranean coast, which probably was no longer in existence even by the time of Yehoshua's conquest of the land of Israel, and therefore there is no reference to it in Tanakh by name, but the name of this place was Ugarit. In English, it's usually spelled U-G-A-R-I-T, in Hebrew with an aleph, Ugarit. And the language and literature of the city of Ugarit are known as Ugaritic. So archaeologists, somewhere in the 1920s, shortly after World War I, dug up a considerable number of cuneiform tablets, clay tablets written in cuneiform symbols, and they were dug up in this city and in other sites in what was Phoenicia. But unlike the cuneiform symbols that they already were accustomed to from Mesopotamia, there was a very big difference when it came to Ugarit. And the difference was that in the Ugaritic language, there were only 30 cuneiform symbols, while in the Mesopotamian languages, Babylonian, Akkadian, Assyrian, there are hundreds of cuneiform symbols. In the older Semitic languages, the languages of Mesopotamia, every cuneiform symbol represented a syllable. Okay? Therefore, however many consonants you have and however many vowels you have, right, that's how many syllables you can produce. So there were literally hundreds of symbols because a language can have hundreds of different syllables. The fact that in Ugaritic there were only 30 symbols was a sign to these archaeologists that the Ugaritic language was not syllabic, but it was consonantal. So they figured out which of these 30 symbols represents which letter of the Semitic alphabet. And the result is that after they copied those texts over into, let's say, Hebrew alphabetic characters, okay, anyone with a thorough knowledge of biblical Hebrew can read Ugaritic. Okay. So Moshe David Casuto, being a Bible scholar, became one of the foremost authorities on Ugaritic language and literature as well. And what we have here in the upper paragraph is one of his observations on the relationship between biblical literature and the literature of ancient Canaan, namely that the intention of Tanakh was to create a new culture, a culture that was principally and fundamentally opposed to the cultures of the ancient Near East. That is to say, it was philosophically opposed to it, it was theologically opposed to it. However, at the same time, it drew upon those cultures and received sustenance from them in what? In all aspects of material day-to-day life, as well as in regard to anything that did not contradict a fundamental principle. So pretty much the same way that in English today, in the English language and literature, we use expressions that originate in Greek mythology, and it doesn't mean that we believe in the pantheon. We can talk about an Achilles heel, right? But it doesn't mean that we necessarily believe that there was a deity named Achilles or a hero named Achilles who was born of a god, right? It's just a figure of speech that we use. So the same way that in English we absorbed figures of speech or expressions that have their roots in Greek mythology, Casuto points out that the Tanakh, Hebrew language and literature, uses figures of speech or expressions that came from Canaanite mythology. Now, while Casuto was able to give many examples of this from his knowledge and studies of Ugaritic, the idea itself was already contained in the Moreh HaNevuchim, in the Guide of Maimonides. Because Maimonides is already written, as you see, the knowledge of pagan attitudes and activities is a prime source for providing the rationales of mitzvot, because the basis of our entire Torah and the axis on which it rotates is to eliminate those attitudes from our thoughts and those traces from existence. Basically, Casuto is restating Rambam. And here you see, Casuto was a rabbi, historian of Italian, specifically Florentine Jewry, an avid scholar of the Bible and the ancient Near East. But he also published, in addition to his studies on biblical literature and on Canaanite literature, he also published a book called Torat HaTeudot, V'Siduram Shel Sifrei HaTorah, a response to the documentary hypothesis and to the critical views on the composition of the Torah, which took the documentary hypothesis to task and critically examined each one of what are called the five pillars of biblical criticism or the documentary hypothesis, which we have not yet gotten into. For example, with respect to the use of divine names, for example, as I pointed out, the critics assign one of the sources of the Torah to one that they call J and the other to E. So with respect to the use of divine names, Casuto cited the evidence of Shema, in which we have the combination Hashem Eloheinu as proof that the Torah recognizes the identical essential nature of the different names, combining the particular and universal aspects of God, and therefore arguing that this is not grounds on which to assign them to different sources. Nechama Leibovitz, not only did she never have a good word to say about biblical criticism, Nechama Leibovitz never had any word to say about biblical criticism. In nothing that she wrote and in none of the lectures that I ever heard from her in person did she ever cite anything from biblical criticism or respond to it. Nonetheless, since I'm moving along chronologically, she's next in line. Nechama Leibovitz was a passionate educator. She, at her own dictate, there is but one word engraved on her tombstone, and that is Mora, teacher. Zionist, once she arrived in the land of Israel in 1930, there was nothing that was going to get her to ever leave again. And a scholar. She probably spent as much time in the Judaica Library of the Hebrew National and University Library in Jerusalem than any other member of the Faculty of Judaic Studies. After immigrating to Israel in 1930, she vigorously taught students in and outside of the classroom, and in 1956 was awarded the prestigious Pras Yisrael, the Israel Prize in the field of education. Through her teaching, she brought numerous people, including non-Jews, to a new understanding of Torah study. She refused to acknowledge that she was a revolutionary in any way, but ultimately her unique achievements changed Orthodox society's perception of a woman's capabilities and undoubtedly opened doors for the female Torah scholars who followed. I show you this book not only because I wrote it. The background to the cover of this book, and I hope you can see it. Do you see my cursor? So if you can read it, I apologize. There was no way to get this any better. But if you bear with me, it says Parashat Bereshit, okay? And following it in parentheses, it says Tav Shin Bet. That would be September or October of 1941. And further along on the same line, it says Shana Rishona. This is a reproduction of the very first Gilayon of Nechama Leibovitz. For 30 years, from 1941 to 1970, Nechama Leibovitz every week would put out a Gilayon, a source sheet. And on the basis of these source sheets, she would conduct the classes that she held in person. But perhaps more than that, these Gilyonot were mailed all over Israel and all over the world. And people, both in Israel, in religious circles, in non-religious circles, soldiers, even during wartime, refuseniks in the old Soviet Union, right, would write out their answers to the questions that Nechama Leibovitz posed in her Gilyonot and would mail them back to her. And she would pick them up at the post office and take them home. And she would sit there with a red pen in hand, and she would go over each and every one, and she would make check marks if they were correct, or she would put X's if they were wrong, and frequently she would even make comments in the side, sometimes like nachon, sometimes lo nachon, and to get a nachon from Nechama Leibovitz was a badge of honor, and to get a lo nachon from Nechama Leibovitz was something that frightened even university professors of Bible who would occasionally attend her classes, and she would call on them, and if they didn't know the answers, boy, did she give it to them. This is probably, I don't know if the Guinness Book of Records has a record for correspondence courses, but if it had a record for correspondence courses, I bet you Nechama Leibovitz would be up there on the top. In any event, as you see, almost single-handedly, she restored the Jewish tradition of Parshanut HaMikra, of traditional biblical exegesis, to a central place amongst Israeli Bible scholars. For Ben-Gurion and other secular Zionist traditional commentators lacked the insight that living in the land of Israel and participating in a state afforded, and therefore they shunned them. Many of Ben-Gurion's secular contemporaries shared his lukewarm attitude toward rabbinic commentary as a guide to the Bible, although a grudging acknowledgement might have been awarded to the medieval Pashtanim, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, as scholarly precursors, the Nechama Leibovitz treated the early Midrashim and Agadot with equal respect. First and foremost, She made it impossible to ignore this indigenously Jewish exegetical tradition. Here, for example, this is not one of the original Gilyonot. The text is original, but the format is not. This is a digital format. There is actually a website. The website is Nechama, NECHAMA.org.IL. And on this website, you can, as you see, you can obtain anyone, the text, the full text of any one of the 30 years worth of Nechama Leibovitz's Gilyonot. I chose this one because, as you can see, it's from this week's Sidra, Parashat Vayakhel, as you can see on the upper right-hand corner. If you look at the upper left-hand corner, you can see that it was circulated originally in Tav Shin Lamed in 1970, which makes it one of the very last of the cycles of the Gilyonot. And as you see, there is a Pasuk that is the focus of the lesson. There is the commentary of Rashi on that Pasuk. And then she asks you to compare that Rashi to another Rashi. And on the basis, at the bottom of the page, she poses two questions. In this case, she sees a contradiction between the texts of the two texts of Rashi. And the first question is, do you see the contradiction, and what is the contradiction? And the second question is, do you think that you can resolve the contradiction? So this is typical of a gilayon, of a worksheet of Nechama Leibovitz. Right, this is simply just the same pasuk, so I brought it in a different format. I don't know whether you're acquainted with this format. We'll get to this later on. This is another contribution of Israeli biblical scholarship. It's called Al HaTorah. It's a website that provides, as you see, the pasuk. If you wish, you can click on a button and you can get an English translation of it. It provides the texts of all of the Aramaic Targumim of the Torah. We'll begin to discuss Targumim next week. It provides a critical text, meaning to say a well-edited text of all of the major medieval and early modern Parshanim. And where they exist in English, it provides them in English as well. As you can see here, for example, on the same line as Rashi, you see the character E, the Latin character E. If this were the website itself and not a picture of it, and I clicked on it, it would give me an English translation of the text of Rashi. And I will just simply close this very brief overview of the Nechama Leibovitz with one of what I have found always to be one of the more enduring and endearing quotations from her. If by virtue of the freedom of choice given to students regarding commentaries, she was a very firm believer that rather than just having students memorize or paraphrase the texts of commentaries, they should have to explain them in their own words, and they should be encouraged to choose among them if there were disagreements. And when she was asked, how can you have a high school student deciding whether Rashi is right or Ramban is right? Nechama Leibovitz replied that if by virtue of the freedom of choice given to students regarded commentaries, the words of the Bible will be endeared to them, something of which she wrote she was certain, then there can be no greater respect for scholars, namely that the words of Torah will be endeared to students thanks to them. The main thing is that they should study Torah from every angle, search it well, choose or reject interpretations, providing that they are engrossed in the study of Torah out of love. And we move to another early modern Israeli religious Bible scholar, Yehuda Elitzur. And again, a quotation very similar to that that we just saw in Nechama Leibovitz. A contemporary parshan, he wrote, is required, of course, to examine things in the light of contemporary knowledge. I mean, we have access to sources to which Rashi was unaware. If he does so, then he is following in the footsteps of the ancients, even if he disagrees with them in a thousand details. On the other hand, he wrote, someone who only copies the ancients and shuts his eyes to newly discovered facts and knowledge is actually abandoning the ways of the ancients and rebelling against them. Gives me an opportunity to point out that Yudalei Tzur was the editor of the Da'at Mikra volume on Sefer Shofetim, which is simply an occasion or an opportunity to acknowledge the Da'at Mikra series as basically the host to a dozen or more modern religious Bible scholars in an enterprise that now, with the completion of the Chamisha Chumshei Torah relatively recently, encompasses all of the 24 canonical books of Tanakh. And again, we'll have something to say about the Da'at Mikra series again in a later session. Of all of the modern religious Bible scholars who have responded in one way or another to the challenge of biblical criticism, the most outspoken and probably the most controversial was the late Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Breuer. Now, there were two. Breuer, of course, is a well-known name. The Rabbi Breuer, the son-in-law of Samson Raphael Hirsch, was the heir to Hirsch's position at the head of the Austritzgemeinde, to that segment of Orthodox Jewry that disassociated itself from other segments in order to maintain its individuality, or if you wish, even idiosyncrasy. And that Isaac Breuer has numerous descendants who have taken up one or another branch of Judaic studies. And for a time, there were two cousins named Mordechai Breuer. There was the Bible Breuer, and then there was the History Breuer. This is Mordechai Breuer, the Bible scholar. His cousin Mordechai Breuer was a well-known and highly regarded historian of modern German Jewry in general and Orthodoxy in particular. And of all the Orthodox approaches to biblical criticism and all the potential theological ramifications of the documentary hypothesis, the most unusual and, as I called it, controversial approach is that of Mordechai Breuer, which he called Shitat HaBechinot, the theory of aspects, an aspect being a perspective. What Breuer basically did was starting with the premise that the documentary hypothesis persists in spite of previous attempts at its refutation. Breuer argued that it is not essentially inimical to Orthodox belief. He wrote, Ma l'chol ha'ta'anot ha'ela? What connection is there between all these critical arguments? Shehin muchachot, they're demonstrable. Mutzdakot, they're legitimate. Mevusasot, they are well-founded. V'le'emuna ha'yehudit ha'amitit, she'torah hi mishamayim, and the authentic Jewish belief that the Torah comes from heaven. And according to at least one midrash, the Torah actually preceded creation by 974 generations. Meaning he's saying that basically Breuer says that if biblical criticism is based on the observation that there are inconsistencies or discrepancies within the Torah, then it is an obligation on religious Bible scholars to explain those inconsistencies and discrepancies, but without coming to the conclusion of the documentary hypothesis. And he writes that even if the accuracy of biblical criticism were to be proven, meaning that if one indeed could finally come up with the evidence that there were different documents from which the Torah was eventually redacted, its conclusions do not affect the pure Jewish faith even one iota. Moreover, he wrote, the scientific conclusions of biblical criticism not only are harmless to faith, but are essential and mandatory for anyone who seeks to interpret the Bible according to its pshat as well as its darash. Meaning, if there are inconsistencies, if there are contradictions, if there are discrepancies, we have to be able to explain them. He wrote this in an article in a journal of religious academicians called Deyot a long time ago. Subsequently, he was interviewed on the subject, and he was asked to reflect on that original article. And here's the reflection. And he wrote that of everyone who read my article, there was barely anyone who understood that I accepted from the Bible critics only the discovery that the Torah has multiple sources. And he maintains that that, namely multiple sources, can be proven scientifically, that is to say, linguistically and literarily. At the same time, I do not accept their opinion that these sources were written by multiple authors. So what do you have? He agrees that there were multiple sources. He doesn't agree that there were multiple authors. So how can there be multiple sources without having multiple authors? He wrote, rather, I instead offer the Jewish belief that they were indeed authored by God. For this question depends solely on faith. Science can offer no opinion on this. That's why he called it the theory of aspects of Bichinot, that God would present the same information, or God would formulate the same law in different ways at different times in order to reflect different aspects or different perspectives on the law. Anyone who seeks to understand the Torah according to its simplest meaning has to explain why the giver of the Torah saw fit to include in it numerous contradictions. Why did he edit it in different styles to the extent that it appears as though it was written by several authors? Why didn't he just give Moses at Sinai a uniform book with no contradictions in content, without divergent styles? Had he done so, even those who reject the Torah's divine origin would have to acknowledge that it was written by one person. So why, as it were, did God undermine himself? Breuer's answer was, in order to be able to provide different perspectives, knowing perhaps that over the course of time, our human perspectives would change. And therefore, the Torah already has built into it a mechanism that enables us to reinterpret it at different times based on different perspectives. And the very last slide in this regard is so contemporary that that the book was published in 2021. It's an approach that is centered in the Yeshivat Hesder in Ma'ale Gilboa, Rav Bigman, and it's kind of like a spin on Breuer. Instead of calling it the Shitat HaBechinot, the theory of aspects, they call it Gishat HaTemurot, the approach of exchanges. And basically what it says, as you see, is that the approach is a new method of studying the Torah, which suggests that a new interpretive model for solving the question of contradictions in biblical law. The approach accepts the claim that there are real contradictions in the Torah, just like Breuer, and suggests that the contradictions are not to be attributed to different authors, but they're the result of tmurot, changes that have occurred in the law for various reasons. The Torah, they maintain, is divine, but it's addressed to humans. Therefore, it sensitively deals with changes in reality, with moral developments, and with changes in the spiritual conditions of the Jewish people. Therefore, God sometimes gave a renewed command that updated a previous command. And again, we'll say a little bit more about this later on. And as long as I was I entered the 21st century, Patur b'lo chlum yefshar. This is perhaps, other than the Shitat HaTmurot, the most recent contribution of religious biblical scholarship. It's the combined work of the well-known Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun and the lesser well-known Shaul Baruchi, in which they started 2 years ago to produce a whole volume on every parasha of the Torah, on every sidra of the Torah. And this is the very first one that they published on the Sidra of Yitro. And you can see that the subtitle of the book is, it's called Mikra, the series is called Mikraot. And the subtitle is Iyun Rav Techumi Batorah, a multidisciplinary approach to the Torah. What's multiple disciplinary approach? Here is the first page of the table of contents of the book. And to simply see, it starts off with Seder HaTorah UPisuk Ta'amim. It simply deals with the consonantal text and with the Ta'amei HaMikra, with the biblical punctuation marks. Then it moves into the substance of the text itself, and you can see that it lists four madorim, four sections. The first section is called Midrashim uParshanim Lefi Nosim. It deals with really the truly classic rabbinic sources, the Talmudic Midrashim, the standalone Midrashim, the medieval exegetes, right? But arranged topically rather than textually. The second is called Mador Lashon HaTorah, the section of Torah language, philology. The third one is called Mada BaTorah, science in the Torah. And you see the subheadings, Historia, I don't think I have to translate that, Geographia, Archaeologia. And finally, the fourth is called Mador Bina BaTorah, comprehension, individual, personal comprehension, and that's subtitled Parshanut Chadasha, new attempts at interpretation. So basically we see that in the tail end of the 19th, early part of the 20th century, we have a transition. Whereas the earlier Bible commentaries, the ones that preceded the 19th century, were really cut from the same cloth. They dealt with rabbinic sources, they dealt with philological sources, occasionally with philosophical sources. In the 19th century, because of the challenges posed by the Enlightenment and Reform, we saw the commentaries of Shadal and Malbim and the Netziv and others, the Ketav HaKabbalah, beginning to respond to some of those changes and some of those challenges. And then we get into the 20th century, where there is the challenge of biblical criticism, but more in the latter half of the 20th century, moving into the 21st century, we have the challenges that are posed simply by all of the new information that is uncovered about the Tanakh or about the era in which the Tanakh was written, the things that are uncovered by archaeologists or that come to light through studies of literature or of history. And with that, we put a sof pasuk to the study of Parshanut, and let me have a peek at the chat and okay. If it was a forward slash and not a backslash, I apologize. My computer has only one slash and I use it all the time, so I can't tell the difference. But I stand corrected. Don't know what that means. I'm sure you'll tell us. A dreidel said to be Rabbi Akiva marked J-E-P-D, which the Roman soldiers saw. No idea.
Based on the
language. Let me finish the others, then I'm glad to hear what it means.
Okay.
How did Rabbi Hoffman feel about Rashbam and others? He uses medieval commentaries freely. His commentaries are best known on the books of Vayikra and Devarim. He has comments here and there on the other Chumashim, but primarily on Vayikra and Devarim, specifically because Vayikra and Devarim are so central to biblical criticism. Vayikra because it's the essence of what they call the priestly source, and Devarim because it is what they call the D or the Deuteronomist source.
Yeah. What I meant was in terms of not always having the commentary follow halacha.
Rashbam always follows halacha.
Well, he said, right, but the controversies about that, it didn't bother him then.
It's an interesting question. There actually was just held in Israel a few months ago, a conference that was focused entirely on David Zvi Hoffman. And I really wonder whether this question came up. The commentary of Rashbam was not particularly well known yet by the end of the 19th, early 20th century. It was first published in Germany somewhere in the second half of the 19th century based on, I mentioned this at the time, based on the discovery by Rosen of a single manuscript. I don't know whether it had achieved enough circulation or whatever to have become a standard for biblical scholarship. I simply don't know. It's an interesting point, and I wonder whether it was raised at that conference.
We can ask Marty Lakshin, who I spoke to a few hours ago, actually, today, but is the world expert on Rashbam, and who gave, of course, a number of talks, which you can find on the Torah Motion website. I can ask him that question exactly, if David Zvi Hoffman, how much he may have used, or people in that time may have used the Rashbam. So please, God, I'll try to get back to you on that.
Chama Leibovitz was very outspoken in many respects, and often said things that lent themselves to interpretations that she didn't necessarily mean. She would always say that if I tried, or other people in the class tried, to introduce something based on archaeology or ancient Near Eastern literature, she would wave it away. She would say, you don't have to know archaeology or the ancient Near East in order to understand Tanakh. But then when Da'at Mikra approached her and asked her to be the editor or the author of one of their commentaries, she declined on the grounds that she doesn't know anything about archaeology or the ancient Near East. So I asked her, you said on one hand that you don't have to know archaeology or the ancient Near East in order to understand Tanakh. So why do you say that you won't write a commentary because you don't know archaeology? And she looked at me like I didn't know anything. And she said, well, Rashi didn't know archaeology in the ancient Near East, and he certainly understood Tanakh. So clearly you don't have to know archaeology in the ancient Near East in order to understand Tanakh. But how can you write a modern commentary on Tanakh without knowing it? So, if she said at one time that she has no derech, she only teaches what the commentaries say, then at that moment it was true. But if you study her iyunim and you study her Gil Yonot, it's abundantly clear that she had a derech. her relationship to her brother. I will share with you what I once heard Professor Uriel Simon say. Professor Uriel Simon, who was very close to both of the Leibovitzes, was himself a professor of Bible at Bar-Ilan University, and son of the equally famous philosopher, Ernst Simon, once said, "I would like to have met the parents of this remarkable, of these remarkable siblings, who, as though they knew that their older child was going to become the great mochiach, the great chastiser of the Jewish people, named him Yeshayahu, and then in the next breath, as it were, to compensate for it, named his younger sister Nechama, consolation." And that's about it.
Yes, okay. Thank you very much. Nechama, I mean, I had the pleasure of, you know, of learning with her for a year. Yeah, of course, she totally had no interest in anything outside of the Mefarshim, you know, the Chumash itself. She wouldn't use outside sources, of course. The cute story, what she didn't know anything about. I don't believe her when she said she doesn't know anything. We asked her to give a shir on a Megillat Esther before Purim. And she said, no, she can't give a shir on Megillat Esther. She doesn't know the Megillah well enough. I mean, that was like, she doesn't know the Megillah well enough, but, her knowledge of, you know, she told me she said she never learned Gemara. She never learned Gemara. Halavai, I should never learn Gemara like she learned Gemara. Because every Rashi that's based on a Gemara in Bava Kama, she knew like Baal Peh with Rashi, Tosfot, everything. But, thank you for that really, overview. And, I really think this is a major distinction between Israel and Chutz Laaretz. The whole revival of Tanakh study is really the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. It just doesn't happen in Chutz Laaretz. And this is all, it's very interesting. And by the way, I'm not familiar. This new journal, Mikrot, I had never heard of it. That just, you know, speaks to my ignorance. But Mikrot, so I don't know, is that even available here? I mean, I have some of your opinion and stuff, but I had never even heard of it until now.
It's not sure. It's a book. It's the book forms.
Right. Each book, each parsha is a whole book. Like
each parsha is a whole book.
Oh my gosh! So like I need a new new wall space in the house, which I don't have. Right. How many have they done?
So far, just Yitro and Mishpatim.
Oh, so far just Yitro and Mishpatim. Okay, so this is like Encyclopedia Talmudit. This is like a 50-year project.
Right, or like Torah Shleima.
Right. Well, Torah Shleima never got finished.
Well, it did finish. It did finish. But you can actually, if you follow it well, if you know it well, I can actually show you where Kasher died.
Like in Makkos, where Rashi dies, you know. And we all know that Bava Batra is the longest Masechet in Shas because Rashi died on Daf Kaf Chet. And the Rashbam took over the commentary, and what Rashi could say in 5 words took 500 words for the Rashbam to say. And therefore, Bava Batra is the longest Masechet in Shas. There's a little note for those in Cheskar Avatim, Kamet Rashi. Here Rashi died, and the rest of the commentary is by his grandson, the Rashbam.
He also died in the 40th chapter of Eov.
He also died in Daf Kapbet and Makos. So Rashi was writing a lot of, I don't know what to say, but it is interesting. It's interesting. It's very beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. The grandson, listen, this is his eldest grandson, taking over, finishing the works that his grandfather could not finish. But, I think what, Mirna was referring to before was, I think you'll correct me if I'm wrong, if you hear that the Rashbam in his commentary will often say things that are non-halachic. Like ayin tachat ayin means an eye for an eye. He himself would tell you we don't follow the pshat. But in other words, he would. I assume that's what you meant. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Right. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Dr. Sokolow.
And by year,
I did at the time. I offered my opinion that Rashbam was not contradicting the halacha. He was giving what he called explicitly the omek pshutel shel mikra, but.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Nechama is Great. I agree with you. Your Haredi relatives adore Nechama. No one can explain why her lesson. You can explain. There are reasons you can explain. I really love the point you said. She didn't see herself at all as a revolutionary. She was like the furthest thing from quote unquote, feminist. She had no interest in those sort of battles that are, you know, so go on today. She just loved Torah, wanted to teach Torah. Anyway, it's okay. Thank you very much.
One quick question. What was the name of the online Israeli sources with the Targum and Rashi and all the other Mefarshim again?
Al HaTorah.
Called Al HaTorah.
Yeah, it's pretty recent. A few years.
It's Al HaTorah, A-L-H-A-T-O-R-A-H, all lowercase, .org.
Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Okay, Lila Tov, everybody. We look forward to learning with you tomorrow, 12 noon. Shuli Mishkan continues your series on biblical archaeology. And tomorrow night, Parsha Shavuot, 8:30. Sometimes we have this. I'm not 1,000% sure who's giving the shiur yet, but there will be a shiur. It might be me. If it's not me, you'll come. You'll enjoy it. The person that was going to give the shiur actually had to move. He had a last minute thing he had to cancel. He's going to be giving it in the future. So it left an opening. But anyways, we will have a partial shiur. We will learn tomorrow night. Please God at 8:30. And then Friday morning, of course, my regular shiur, please God, 9 a.m. on the Siddur. Rabbi Liebtag starting up again Sunday morning at 11:15 Eastern. And, Aaron Kohler continued his wonderful series on Megillat Esther at 9:30 on Tuesday morning, and Alex Israel at 1 p.m. and in between Rachel Sharansky Dansker at 11 a.m. in the morning, our triple header. And Wednesday, next week, we'll be in Madrid, Spain, Mark Shapiro doing our Jewish communities around the world at 2 p.m. Listen, Chaim today is quite fascinating, his talk on Greece, and then next Wednesday night, back to Dr. Sokolov. We're starting UBC on the Targumim, right? That's what you said. Yeah. Okay. And okay, everybody be well. Lila Tov, we look forward to learning.
Who is B?
Where were you in New Jersey last week?
Where was I in New Jersey last week? We were visiting my daughter and son-in-law in Princeton. And it was really nice. The first time we could go there, really. And first time we could drive across the border in almost 3 years. And, yeah.
Rafael, may I ask, because I see something in the chat. Who is B?
I don't know.
I'm here, yeah.
He asked in his Torah commentary, who is much less verbose compared to his Talmudic one.
Correct.
So I will share with you an insight that was shared with me by Robert Gordas. Robert Gordas pointed out that we know that the commentary, the Talmudic commentary of Rashi that we have is in some cases the third edition. Meaning we know that Rashi completed a Talmud commentary and then revised it. So what Gordas suggested was that what we have in Bava Basra and elsewhere is not an original commentary by Rashbam, but it's Rashbam redacting the Mahadura Basra of Rashi. And that's why the style and the syntax are more Rashi-like than Rashbam-like. So that addresses your astute observation.
You're saying his Perush on Chumash is based on Rashi.
No. That is his Talmud. The commentary of Rashbam on the Torah is very succinct.
Correct. Right. And the Talmud is very
on Shas is all 100%.
Right.
So Gordas suggested that it shows that it's not an original Rashbam commentary, but rather Rashi died before he could complete the last revision of his Talmud commentary.
Rashi would write very long.
This is Rashbam redacting the Mahadura Basra of Rashi.
According to that, then there was Rashi would write 5,000 words, and then he'd edit it down to 50 words, basically. I mean, you know, exaggerating, but that's very, I never heard such a theory before, but okay.
No, not the Torah.
No, I understand that. But Rashi is so succinct in the Talmud. And if the Rashbam is based on Rashi, what basically we're saying is before Rashi died, all the stuff he did do, he had these long commentaries, but the ones he actually published, quote unquote, were he really shortened that, which makes a lot of sense. Anybody who writes knows we do that all the time. You write a lot and then you read it over and you take this out and, you know, it changes. So that's a very fascinating theory that I never heard anybody. That's okay. In fact, I didn't, does anybody else say that? Like, is it, I don't know. It sounds very, and so the Rashbam didn't, I don't know.
Gordas had a lot of those.
Doesn't sound, I don't know, just reading the Rashbam, it doesn't sound like it's Rashi elongated. I don't know. Okay. Okay, everybody. Laila Tova. It's nice to see everybody still there learning. Okay. Doctor, we'll see you next week and everybody be well. Hopefully we'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Have a wonderful night. Bye bye.
Thanks.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.